Jenkins.
And welcome aboard. It's Saturday night. We call it Open Mind. And what a night we have in store for you tonight. It certainly is almost deja vu for me and for those of you that have been along on these little seminars we take every Saturday night. This trip into a new time and space and place. It'll be, some old friends will come for you. I remember back in that November day of 1979, the very first Open Mind show that I did. It was a new journey for me that night, and we want to pick up that journey. We talked about it a lot. It was the fascinating experience of a gentleman by the name of Billy Meyer, one-armed farmer that lived in Switzerland, that back in 1975, 76, just for some reason or another happened to have an ongoing series of contacts with beautiful ladies who came in spacecraft and talked to him. They identified themselves as being from the Pleiades star cluster, a planet up there called Hera. Well, the story was imaginative, but what was interesting about the story and grew more and more interesting was that it was supported by hundreds of photographs and also some movie footage, rock and mineral samples, alloy samples. Marcel Vogel, who was here on the show, Dr. Marcel Vogel, then with IBM, said he had never seen metal samples like that. He had never seen an alloy like that. He had never seen one that could be milled like that. He had a chance to sample those. So there were a lot of things about the Billy Meyer story. They led us to believe that there was something very true about it. Tonight, we have with us one of the chief investigators on that case as it transpired, started some time ago, and I'm very delighted to have him with us tonight, speaking to us from Arizona, Mr. Lee Elders. Lee, welcome back to Open Mind.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Well, I'm just doing fine, and I'm looking forward to what we have going tonight. Because I think tonight, Lee, we'll have one of the first opportunities to, as our good friend Paul Harvey would say, get the rest of the story.
Well, let's hope so.
A lot of things have happened with the Billy Meyer case. When it first started getting national attention, it was exciting to a lot of people. And then a lot of people decided that this really wasn't true, that the photographs were all rigged, the sounds were wrong. And what went wrong? What happened? Why was that?
Well, that's a very complex question. Let me try to answer it this way. In 1978, when we first got involved, we had a lot of pioneering to do. And one of the first things we wanted to do with this case is keep it out of the politically charged atmosphere of ufology. And I think in doing this, I think we create a lot of enemies. And I think a lot of disinformation came down about the case.
Well, a lot of enemies in that you didn't share a lot of information with them as the chief examiners over there or the people getting into it. That seems to be a lot of the input I had.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Bill. Although we did make overtures to one very large UFO organization. We asked them if they wanted to get involved with us. We asked their director. At that time, the answer was no. The reasons given, the long distance over there, we don't have the funds to do it. We don't have the manpower to do it. If you want to pay our expenses, take us with you, we'll be glad to go. At that point in time, we felt, well, let's pass on this one. Let's go see what we can find out. This is what we did. Later on, when we came back, we started bringing evidence, hard evidence, back with us. All of a sudden, they wanted to get involved. They wanted us to turn information over to them. Certain photographs, certain negatives, metal samples, things of this nature. Obviously, we refused.
Now, Lee, I know you're stuck up there in the woods in northern Arizona. I wonder if you could talk a little closer into the telephone there or something.
Let me try changing phones here. That might help.
Okay. We're speaking to Lee Elders, who, along with Lieutenant Colonel retired Wendell Stevens, were the chief investigators of this very fascinating case of Billy Meyer. A case now in which there are a number of eyewitnesses. There have been some incredible things that have happened over there.
Bill, is this any better?
That's 100% better.
Okay.
You get an A on that one.
All right. So much for the headset.
Okay.
Now, where were we?
All right. So you were talking with one of the large UFO organizations, as my memory recalls. That was APRO. That they wanted to get involved after you'd started doing the spade work.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, you know, going back to that beginning, let's go back in a proper manner here. First of all, Wendell Stevens, retired Air Force colonel, been chasing UFOs for some 30 years. He approached us in 1977 and asked us to get involved with this case in Europe. Approaching us, meaning approaching Intercept, a security firm that I own. I asked him, why did he want us involved? He said, well, I want professional investigators. We were honored at the time, but we were not interested. At that time, we were dealing with a lot of multinational clients. And our feeling was, you know, the field was so stigma-ridden that we really didn't want to get involved. Wendell was persistent. He went over. He came back. I noticed a big change in him. And at that point, we decided to throw our hat in the ring because he had brought back a lot of hard evidence. And this excited us. So then we jumped in. We got involved. Our first trip was April 1978. My wife, Britt, and I, Wendell went over, spent 5 days there. I was impressed by Meyer, but I still wasn't convinced. I felt that maybe the guy is hoaxing it, but how is he hoaxing it? So at that point in time began about a two-year search, my own search, to try to determine if this guy was real or not. In the meantime, the UFO groups were really on our case real bad. They were claiming we didn't have any evidence. First, they were claiming we were withholding evidence. Then they started claiming we didn't have any evidence. Then later on, claims were made that we'd stolen some of the evidence, meaning from Marcel Vogel. Talking about metal specimens now.
Mm-hmm.
So, it got deeper and deeper. Finally, got to the stage. They were no longer interested in looking at any evidence. They became very interested in character assassination. At that stage, we pulled our horns in, Bill. We said, none of this. We sat on the evidence, and we took our lumps for several years.
You know, I have a question that just comes to mind here, Lee. Something I want you to mull over as we take just a little break here. Here is a man who claims to be having one of the most, should be one of the most fascinating experiences the whole world should be deeply interested in. He's talking to astronauts from a very different place. They are telling him many things about our beginnings, about our history, what's wrong in our society, how we can solve it. Have made offers to do a lot of things for us. And who is it that goes and investigates this? The governments? The Air Force? No, it's UFO groups. Why is that? If this is so, and he had that kind of information behind him, where was Uncle Sam? Where were people who could really, totally get involved and do a first-class job instead of, not that you didn't, but other than flying saucer groups who happen to have an interest in that. I'm Bill Jenkins, talking to Lee Elders tonight. We're talking about the UFO in general, but certainly the UFOs from Pleiades in particular. Is it that the investigation of something which had all of the earmarks of being vitally important to the world was left to just private individuals instead of getting the kind of attention you would think that it should have?
Well, in the beginning, you know, this bothered me as much as anything because, you know, Intercept had a track record. We had worked with various government agencies in the past. We knew their modus operandi in certain areas. But we couldn't really see anything on the surface here that indicated that they were involved, that they were interested in this case. But today, 5 years later, we're finding out a lot of things. We're finding out that there was a lot of behind-the-scenes activity going on.
On the part of government?
We think so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the metal areas, especially in other areas, especially the hard evidence.
The hard evidence. Photographs, movies, rock and mineral samples. Even samples of hair. Of course, the hair was like anybody else's hair, so you can't really say that that was much evidence there. What's happened to all of that evidence?
That's a good question. One of the major problems when, let's go back to the beginning again. Right before Intercept got involved, I told Wendell, I said, look, if we're going to get involved, we definitely want to control whatever evidence comes. We want to make sure that it is protected. We want security around this man. We want to protect him because at that period of time, he'd already had some attempts against his life. So
why had he had attempts on his life?
Well, there were many and various reasons. There was one woman, Billy has never told us who she is, but he said later on she joined their group or became involved with their group. But she tried to shoot him. She felt that he was part of a satanic situation that was developing around the Antichrist. She thought he might be one of the Antichrists because of the seven sisters, the Pleiadian contact. Somewhere in the Bible it mentions, I think, that the Antichrist movement would begin in a connection with seven. And a lot of people thought for many years it might be the seven hills of Rome, might be Catholicism.
Well, seven is just permeating throughout the Bible.
Totally, yes.
It's built upon sevens.
Yes.
In a very majestic mathematical way.
But going back to your earlier question, we did our damnedest to provide security on this, but we ran into a major problem when it came to the scientist. We lost several negs, internegatives, because we had to ship them off to scientists. We couldn't get people to come into Phoenix and analyze the material. So eventually we had to begin to trust various scientists. And of course we made some bad choices in the beginning, some bad picks. And also, there seems to be some form of an obsessive energy or quality that develops when it comes to the Pleiadian case. People that get information, that receive information, all of a sudden feel that they don't want to part with it any longer. They don't want to return it to the original owner. Billy ran through this before we ever got to him. He had lost hundreds of photographs.
Souvenirs, as it were.
Pardon me?
Souvenirs of some sort.
Oh, yes, yes. It's like a friend once told me who was in the gold dredging business down in South America. He said, you know, you can take the most honest dredge people that work on these dredges. I mean, they wouldn't steal anything, but yet when it comes to that river and those gold nuggets start coming up through that suction hose, they see one, they like it, and they stick it in their pocket. And to them, it's not stealing. And I think that analogy held true for this case as well. They didn't feel they were stealing anything. They felt it was in better hands, quote unquote. So we ran into problems there. And when we did, we started losing material. We lost metal fragments. We lost negatives. We lost a lot of things.
Well, some of the pictures that came out of it, there have been great cries that they were fakes or that they were models.
Well, you know, it's easy to sit back in the United States or any country and look at Volume 1 or Volume 2 and say, my God, those pictures are, they're great, they're beautiful, they're the best we've ever seen, the best photo evidence to date. But, and so many of the so-called, quote, experts said this, they said, but they're too good to be true. And I had the same feelings when Wendell brought those photographs in. I'm sorry, when Lou Zinstock brought the first Meyer photographs in to his house down in Tucson, Britt and I, we were staying there with him, and my first reaction, Bill, was, hey, these are too good to be true. We've never seen anything like this. So the point of the story is this. It's easy to second-guess things. But I went there, and I walked those sites, especially Hassan Bull. I've been to Hassan Bull probably a dozen times. And every time I've been there, the wind is blowing fiercely there. It's always cold. It's windswept. And how a man, or anybody, especially a one-armed man, could hang a model there is beyond me. I just rule that out. It was totally impossible. Then when you see the beam ship movie footage, forget it. These definitely are not models.
Well, in the beam ship movie footage, there is one section, and I, you know, I mentioned that to you, that looks like it may be a model hanging on a string. Until you look at it closely, it doesn't behave quite like a model. Obviously, it was very, very windy. And this model also was causing the top of the tree to bend.
Right.
And that would have to be one heck of a model.
Well, that's a general consensus of a lot of friends that I've showed this footage to, and the same thing. Another thing you want to look at in that one segment, you're talking about the segment now where the beam ship flies around the tree and over the farmhouse, right?
Right, uh-huh. In a sort of a circular thing.
Right.
I realized that Semjassy the astronaut was trying to keep the beam ship in camera range at all time, for it was a photo opportunity for Billy Meyer. But she was doing pretty good at that.
Well, you know, there's a real mystery to that segment. I want to share it with you because very few people know this. In 1978, when Wendell brought back the movie footage, he brought back a copy of the 8mm footage. And we must have watched this 20, 30 times in his home, throwing it up on a wall or throwing it up on a screen. And never once in that year and a half period did we ever see that tree move with this scene we're talking about now. I never saw it move until the Japanese NTV arrived at the Meyer farmhouse. And the beam ship footage is compiled of what they shot in Meyer's living room off the wall with their video camera. And that was the first time that we saw the tree move. Number one, we were dealing with Billy's second or third generation copy. His original had already been stolen. But Wendell had like a sixth or seventh generation copy. And of course, the resolution was so bad, you couldn't see the tree move. So, again, going back to photography, this is one of the things you have to look for, and that's how many generations down are you dealing with?
You know, I should mention something here, Lee. We're talking about the beam ship footage. I know many of those in this audience have seen Contact from Pleiades, number one, and perhaps volume two. They both have been published by Genesis 3, which is your company. And now you are making available a 90-minute home cassette, video cassette, for the people, which includes the movie footage taken by Billy Meyer,
mm-hmm.
plus interviews with Billy Meyer that the Japanese, the group from Nippon Television took. And you were kind enough to send me my copy, which I value, as I did Volume 1 and Volume 2. And they are fantastic.
You know what's unique about that footage now? You have to remember, Bill, we sat on that for almost 5 years. Now, we sat on it during the time when our critics were saying that we didn't have any evidence. They were saying a lot of things. But, you know, as it is now, the timing is right, and we're now ready to release it so that the people can see what we've seen since 1978 and 79. And what's amazing about Beam Ship, the movie footage, is the fact there are eight segments of movie footage that are all daylight. One segment of night footage. But in each segment of daylight footage, there's a different scene. There's a different situation. You have one where Meyer walks into the scene. The beam ship is hovering above. You have another, which is my favorite, and others, where this well-traveled highway, you see this beam ship hovering over. And you can count four different automobiles. Automobile traffic that travels beneath the beam ship as it sort of just lumbers there silently, just hovering above. So it's amazing footage. We've never seen anything like this before.
Well, I was intrigued by the footage where the beam ship just in a twinkling changes positions and then just disappears.
Which so is the Japanese.
Which is a part of the technology of the ship, as has been explained to us by Wendell. And I think you went in that with us one night. We also had an explanation given to us by Edwin Slade, who spent some time with Smith Rudy here about 6 weeks ago when he was with us. And there you can see in these tapes that actually happened. So you're making it available for home video consumption, VHS or Beta, huh?
Yes, we are. It's the only UFO, and we don't like to use that word UFO anymore.
And they're IFOs.
I think IFO is much better because they identify themselves. but we are making it available to the public to let everybody decide for themselves whether this is a model or if it's for real. And I think that's the key thing to this whole case, because I think a certain percentage of the public will always feel that it's a hoax, and another percentage will always feel that it's real. We've seen these percentages work for 5 years now. And one of the reasons we're releasing this is you decide. In other words, after you see it, you decide. And that's all we're asking.
Well, one thing, it seems to me, for it to have been a hoax, that Billy Meyer, the little one-armed farmer in Switzerland, way outside of Zurich there, would have had to have been able to access special effects studios that are at least within range of what we have here in Hollywood. And there aren't any over there. So
and, not only that, Bill, I mean, we're talking 10 years ago.
Right.
We're talking 1975 and 76 when he gathered most of the hard evidence. And, you know, a lot has happened since 1975 and 76. Today we can look at the shuttle, for example. We know that they're creating metals in space and crystals. So that's no biggie. But in 1975 it was. I mean, a cool fusion process for metal. Come on. And this is what blew the scientists away.
It was a cold rolled way of making an alloy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how or why we should do anything like that.
That's right.
There's some question about whether there was calcium in it or not.
There were traces. There was also thulium. And this, I think, really disturbed Vogel more than anything else. I just finished editing our next tape, and it's called Beamship the Metal, and we're releasing the metal analysis, and most of it is was footage taken at IBM when Vogel was with IBM in his laboratory there.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it is microscopy work combined with interview with Yowie. And it's fascinating because this first piece, Vogel remarks over and over, he cannot get over the purity of this material. Highly crystalline material in metal. Unheard of. Why would anybody want to do that?
And it was a great deal of lead and copper and brass and things that you wouldn't think would be in a flying machine, but all great conductors of electricity.
Yes.
Very fascinating stuff. And we have a lot more for it to go with you. We're just getting started on Open Mind tonight. With me is Lee Elders, speaking to us from Alexandria, too. And Lee, I think they have the beamship tape there, in fact.
I think they do, yes.
And I don't think they can keep it because everybody wants to see it.
I hope so.
If you wanted to get it, what do you have to do? Can we buy them from you?
Well, one of the things now, we're getting so close to Christmas that we would suggest anyone wanting this tape or the metal tape, just write to us. We're in Arizona. Is it all right to give the address here, Bill?
Yeah, we're going to do it officially later, but you can go ahead and do it now.
Well, it's real simple. Just Genesis 3. Genesis is the distributor of the tape. Genesis 3, Post Office Box JJ, and that's Munns Park, Arizona, 86017. And we'll try to get it to you by Christmas. If you send us a check or a money order, either way.
What is it, 59 then?
59.95, yes. Uh-huh.
59.95. And we'll have those addresses for you as we go on. I thought we might take just a moment here, if you don't mind. You sent me a fascinating piece of audio tape. And I want to share the sounds of the spacecraft. And Lee, I'd like for you to set the scene of what we're going to listen to here.
Okay, the setting is 1982. The sound analysis was one of our last priorities, Bill. We had already been... Oh, we'd spent about 3 or 4 years on the photos.
But this is radio.
Pardon me?
I says, but this is radio, so
right.
The sound analysis is important to us.
Yes, and we finally got around to it in 82. There had been some preliminary work done by Delatoso and others, but in 82, we took it into Los Angeles to a laboratory there, and we had two gentlemen really look at it close on their equipment. And coming up, you will... probably hear my wife, Britt, she was present, and Wendell Stevens, and Steve Ambrose, and Niels Rognerud.
What lab was this?
This was Excalibur Studios in North Hollywood.
All right. So you're there, and it's just sound tape you're working with that Billy Meyer had recorded.
Yes.
And
this is variation. This is the second tape that he had made. The first tape was about 40 minutes. It was on variation 2, The Craft, and this is on variation 6.
It's interesting, as this contact went along with Billy Meyer, that they kept coming up with new models of the spacecraft all the way through.
Well, you know, to an investigator, this has to blow you away, because every time we get this guy in one arena and think we had him surrounded, you know, like still photography, he would jump into another arena. He would take us there like sounds or metal.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a never-ending chase. So anyway, it was a fascinating experience, and coming up is this tape.
All right. I want to share this moment with you as you're listening to the investigators themselves, as well as sound engineers, dealing with the perplexing things that they are seeing on their scopes as they listen to the sounds of the Variation 6 Pleiadian spacecraft.
Yes. What?
Take 6.
It's very random. You see, there are maybe 20 predominant pinks.
We just need some clean traffic.
One measures the signal we listen to in the time domain, the top one here,
mm-hmm.
and the bottom one is measuring the frequency components of the signal. And as we can see, it's changing both on the top and bottom. The small instrument on the top here measures the main frequency component on the signal. At the moment, it's around 1,000 cycles per second, which is right in the middle of your voice spectrum. Now, there we had a very pure tone, with very little added noise or other harmonics.
But it's still it's an alignment of several tones. It's not as though it just
There's an alignment of maybe 10 different tones.
So third is again. What's that? Okay. What does that mean?
Well, all of the spurious tones that you were getting before.
Have it there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are tuning and aligning to the same frequency, or not exactly the same frequency, but near enough that they. It's not as though those different frequencies are falling out and one is coming through. They're aligning. You have it. See, it's. You understand what I'm
saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not as though maybe before you had 10 different frequencies at random, and then all of a sudden 9 dropped out and you only had one left. What's happening is the 10 different frequencies are converging on one central frequency, which is, I find, very interesting because...
These are fucking analyzing tones right now. There's already a lot of changes that you've got on the spectrum analyzer. What is it telling you?
Okay, let's pick a point here on the screen. Let's pick that point there. You see how the level of that point is changing, it's going up and down.
So you can see that there was a great deal of interest that was being demonstrated by the sound engineers as they heard these sounds that Billy Meyer recorded of the...